Warning. Critique Revolve contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
I remember my birthday party. Church was out on the road. And everything went black.
It's okay now. Are you back?
Back from where?
What's going on?
There's a place rage brings things back. Oh, your daughter.
Are you happy, Mommy?
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Critique Revolve on Rain Man Digital. I am your host tonight, Thomas Cowley. Joined with me is Michael Flores.
Hey.
And we are going to be discussing the latest iteration of Pet Sematary. And this one is one of Stephen King's more notable works, based on the 1983 book and the second version of a movie adaptation, the original being in 1989. And Stephen King's stuff has definitely been on a little bit of a prominent rise lately. I don't know if people just finally are trying more of his stuff after a number of years, or if he made some big deal worldwide kind of thing, because we've had Stephen King's It Chapter 1, which did very well and I was a big fan of. We've had The Dark Tower, which did very poorly and was hot garbage.
Let's not even bring that one up, please, Thomas. Are you trying to make my mood even worse than it is?
And we've had Castle Rock, which I was a big fan of and has been renewed for a second season.
Fantastic series.
Yeah. Very, very good. Underrated, truthfully.
Yeah, it did not get enough.
Nowhere near enough attention at all.
Yep.
But, you know, just on the movies alone, we've had a big hit and a big miss, which has kind of been Stephen King's movie track record. If you look at all of his works, which is a shocking number, have been adapted to the screen. Not many of them are good, or we're sitting at like a 40% good, 60% not so good, or just flat out bad as far as his adaptations go.
Yeah.
And some of the ones that are good are ones that are not what he wrote or changed significantly. The most standout being Kubrick's The Shining.
Yeah. And for years, because of that, for years, I just refused to watch any films that were adapted from his work.
Yeah.
Because his work is very hard to adapt. It's very poetic. There's it's very wordy. And, you know, sometimes he'll take 15 pages to describe a moment.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that does not work for movies.
Right. And to your point, it's not just that he takes so long and uses a lot of poetic, you know, prose in his books, but it's that his biggest strength is that his characters are very real. A lot of his stories, the ideas are okay or decent or even good, but the endings suffer sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's always been the characters that keep the book going, keep you interested. I recently read Pet Sematary. I just finished it a few months ago for the first time, and it's a little bit of a spoiler, I guess, but it's an adaptation of a book that's over 30 years old, so fuck it.
I think you're good, Tom.
It is one of the most depressing books I've ever read. It just gets worse, essentially.
Well, that's what you said, because I had always veered away from seeing this movie, the original.
The original, 89.
And you said, man, it is a sad, sad story.
It's a sad story where essentially nothing goes right, but it's also very cathartic in that way due to the themes, the tackling of death and how we as humans understand it, relate to it. And
well, whenever you have to question your existence, it creates just a fantastical
existential crisis.
Yeah, it's a great way to explore something philosophical from a philosophical aspect. And that's something I always enjoy. And that is the reason why I am drawn to a lot of Stephen King's books, because he puts a lot of that stuff into his books.
Yes. And I think the adaptations that do well try to translate a lot of that too. It's not just the concept, it's the human nature. I think Shawshank is perhaps one of the greatest examples of that. It's a good story, but it's how real it feels, how human it feels, that helps bring it to life. Same thing with Green Mile. And on the other end, for away from the drama, there's the same thing with the recent movie It, Chapter One. So Pet Sematary, though, being as depressing as it is, would always be hard to adapt because it's not a happy ending traditionally. It's not a happy story.
And we all like happy endings.
We all enjoy a good rub and tug.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes you don't always get what you pay for.
Yeah. Well, I usually ask for rusty trombones, and they just look at me weird. Like, they don't understand what I'm
talking
about.
That's a bit of an odd choice.
Well, okay, so rub and tug's okay, but a rusty trombone, you're gonna judge me on that?
It's a lot more involved.
I like effort. it shows me they really care about me.
I don't know if we'll just remove that. Now, this new iteration was directed by Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer, and written by Jeff Buhler. Is that how I'd say that?
Yeah.
I don't know. And we have Jason Clark, Amy Semetz, and John Lithgow as the starring cast for this one. And the thing about Pet Sematary is that we're going to look at this both as a movie and as a adaptation, which we haven't had one of those in quite some time outside of comic books, which are, as long as you got the origin generally close and the costume close,
yeah,
that's all people cared about. But with Pet Sematary, the story doesn't have a lot happening until about the midway point. It's a lot of dread and continuously building towards something much greater for a final crescendo.
A lot of atmospheric mood setting.
Yes. And a lot of the strength of the story comes from, you know, something bad's going to happen, but you're stuck on this roller coaster and you're stuck on this road trip to hell. So you might as well enjoy the sights along the way. But like we said, one of the greatest aspects is that it's understanding of human nature and its themes amongst death.
Right. And which those are strong ingredients.
Especially you would think, for a horror movie.
You would think.
That's called foreshadowing. No. The Pet Sematary finds itself in an odd place. And I'm kind of beating around the bush at this point. But it finds itself in an odd place being so short on the heels of Jordan Peele's Us. A standout horror movie that we haven't had arguably maybe since Jordan Peele's Get Out a few years prior.
I'd agree.
And when you set the bar that high, whether you understood it or not, because again, many people probably didn't. When you set the bar that high, we're going to look at everything that comes after so closely. And we've had a bit of a horror movie resurgence where people at least respect them and they're becoming profitable beyond just, it released on Halloween and I want to see the Saw number 18.
Right.
What else can we chop off?
Right.
There's been a little bit more effort.
And because of that effort, because one or two directors made that great horror flick recently, you have this push to with other
up the bar.
Yes, well, we have to do this as well. And because of that, we are getting some rather good horror films.
A lot of things that are unsettling too, not just we got away from the torture porn and gore that we've had in the mid 2000s.
And we're getting more into that psychological mood setting.
Unhealthy, disturbed, what is going on? I don't understand.
Yeah.
We're away from slasher, we're away from body horror. Now we're in a really big mind fuckery.
Right.
Period.
And that's what was the strength of Hereditary. I mean, 99% of the fear tactics in that was all mood.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that Pet Sematary did have some of that. It did have a good mood.
It does for the most part.
It stumbles through it a little bit, but it did create a mood for the most part. There is that sense of dread and you're waiting to see something jump out of the shadows because they lay it on thick.
Yeah. But you don't get that ultimate payoff simply because they seem to change tactics halfway through.
See, what I got was that they just weren't quite sure what they were trying to do.
I think that's why they changed tactics.
Yeah.
So from a general weakness of understanding what you wanted to be.
Yeah.
And as an adaptation, Pet Sematary does a pretty faithful job until about the halfway point. Again, a little bit of spoilers, not giving away too much unless you've read the books or seen the other movies. Until about the halfway point, it's pretty close to the story. A lot of the same beats, a lot of the same actions. However, the greatest strength is the characterization of these people. of Lewis Creed, a doctor from Boston who's moved his family out into the small town of Ludlow, Maine, to get away from it all, to get away from the city, to get away from the stress of the ER. He's taken his family out into the country, a pretty standard horror movie setup. But here the strength is that it's not the house that's haunted or something that goes bump in the night. It's that there's this place beyond the woods called the Pet Cemetery where kids bury their animals in a sense of respect. But neighbor, old man Judd Crandall knows something about the true Pet Cemetery beyond the woods. And this movie has very much of a man against nature and man against himself concept going through it, where the villain is less the clown Pennywise or something nefarious as it is man not knowing his place.
Yeah.
Nature itself is greater than we can expect. And beyond the veil, beyond the original children's Pet Cemetery, is a place of greater power that is something that we shouldn't be dealing with. And unfortunately, the entire story hinges on the characterization that these relationships, why Lewis would talk to Judd, why he would even consider some of the actions he takes throughout the movie, depend on their being friends.
Yeah. That's my biggest problem with this movie. Let's just get it
out
there.
Let's just get to it.
Like, that's my biggest problem with this movie is that you have a feeling they're working towards something, right?
Yeah.
The entire movie, they're working. You can physically see the director's brain. You can practically see the director's brain steaming as he's trying to figure out how he's going to get to the final act. And as we're working, nothing pays off because it feels very haphazard. Nothing really fits. It feels like a fragmented puzzle. Not even a puzzle. It feels like a fragmented picture that you're missing pieces to and you're trying to make them fit.
You're reading the story. You're watching the movie on fast forward and you didn't even know it. They are blazing through events and beats to try and hit the end.
And it's a waste of talent because you have Jason Clarke, who is fantastic. I watch everything he's in. John Lithgow, I mean, come on.
Fantastic. Fan favorite.
Yes, amazing actor, amazing talent. And they waste it.
Yep.
Because half, as you mentioned, half of this story relies on the relationships between these characters. In order for us to believe what's coming down the road, we have to believe their relationships. We have to believe them as characters. And there's never that connection. You never believe anything anyone's saying. It feels like they are literally
reading a script.
Yeah, it feels like they're literally going through the motions. Like, hey, I'm painting by numbers. That's what it felt like. And that's what this movie really comes down to. A lack of commitment. And the fact that it feels like the director doesn't know how to direct horror and he's going through the beats that he thinks he's supposed to put in there.
Yeah.
And that could be partially Kevin Kulscher's issue, or it could be his partner, Dennis Widmeyer, or it could be the writing. It's really hard to say because honestly, this movie just never truly gets.
It never takes off.
When it's about to get going, the movie's over. And a lot of those fears that they try to build up to just amount to like comedic aspects. It's not supposed to be funny. There's parts where you chuckle. The audience was laughing at very serious moments that should be horrifying. And they're not horrifying because they come off as a joke.
Yeah.
This isn't a satire type of horror.
This isn't Jordan Peele's humor is deliberate. This isn't Danny McBride's Halloween, where I'm just a comedy writer and don't know any fucking better. This is, I thought that would be scary. Someone, whether the director, the writer, someone thought that would work, and it doesn't.
Well, and because of the shoddy writing and because of the possibly the directing, when you're dealing with Jason Clarke and John Lithgow, chances are it's not their fault. It's a director's fault. He's not able to get them to do the things they need to do. And unfortunately, for you to believe everything that's working or everything that's going to happen, you have to believe them. You have to believe they're in. You have to believe
it's real.
You have to believe their resolve. And suddenly there's this leap of faith with these characters. And you're like, okay, how did you get there?
Why would you do that? You have shown no believable relationship to where I would think, he would logically make this step.
again, this makes me feel like the director and the writer both knew that it wasn't working.
Yeah. And they were just trying to get it done.
Because there's moments where they just spell it out for you, where the actors will actually talk about it. They will talk about it. So rather than building it up and using the fantastic mood, because that is the best part about this movie for me, was the mood.
Yeah.
The overall mood they created was fantastic. But the dialogue, the shot, the horrendous dialogue between the actors, it pulls you out and destroys any mood that they had built up.
And the thing is, the dialogue's in the book. They rip some exact quotes, more the more famous ones, but they're delivered with such lack of enthusiasm, lack of, as you said, resolve, yeah, believability, that I think the directors just couldn't direct these actors. There's no reason John Lithgow should have such a dead emotional performance for Judd Crandall, a character that South Park did a better joke version of in an episode of that's 20 minutes long. There's no reason that it should have happened.
And okay, well, this should explain a lot of things to people. Okay, now I will be the first one to admit that I have some guilty pleasures. Mm-hmm. And the MTV Scream TV series was one of them. I enjoyed the Scream TV series for what it was. It was schlocky. It was cheesy. It was supposed to be. That was the entire point. It wasn't a B horror. It was a C horror.
Oof.
And the writer of that series wrote this.
And the directors.
I'm sorry. The director of that series.
Okay.
Actually directed this movie. And it made perfect sense because there is a lot of issues with the Scream TV series when it comes to acting. And I'm like, well, there you go. I mean, not to mention the writer, Jeff Buhler, he wrote, this is what he wrote.
Yeah, okay? Nothing.
Nothing. He wrote the Night Flyers TV series, which was supposed to be good, that aired on Sci-Fi Channel this past, I believe, the winter season.
2018, yeah.
And it was, it's the series that was based on the dude that did Game of Thrones.
George R. R. Martin.
Yes, him. There's a lot of hype on it.
Yeah.
I quit watching it after 8 episodes.
Oh, really?
There was two episodes left.
You didn't finish it?
Nope.
It falls apart.
I gave it a chance because I thought it was going to come together. And it is awful. It is an awful TV series.
That's a shame.
And once again, I'm like, well, the executive producer and writer of Night Flyers is the writer of Pet Sematary. And all of it makes sense.
Well,
you have a bunch of talent. I hate to be a dickhead.
You gotta say it.
You have talentless writers,
yep,
talentless directors trying to remake an iconic piece of pop culture.
And it's not the only one, because he, as a writer, Jeff Buhler, has not only Jacob's Ladder slated for 2020.
Oh, Jesus
but
Christ.
But The Grudge.
Yeah.
You are giving somebody who has – the way I've described the writing of this story was somebody who wrote – the guy who wrote this – was told the cliff notes by the guy who read the Wikipedia page secondhand.
That's the best way to frame this entire movie.
You've got the general outline of events, but you've missed all characterization, all thematic elements, all symbolism, the reason behind it.
What are those things? I'm just wondering.
The fucking reasons, like, you tell a story.
What are those things? Because I don't think anybody involved in the creative process of this film understood any of that. Any of that.
You're right.
When the biggest fear in this film are two aspects that don't really matter. Well, I'll take that back. The biggest fear, this isn't a spoiler. The biggest fear in this entire movie that made me jump was a semi-truck going by their home really fast. And you saw that in the trailer.
Yeah, it's in the trailer. First 5 minutes of
the movie. That is the scariest part of the entire movie.
Yeah.
And there's a couple other, I guess you can call scares, that we'll talk about towards the end when we get into spoilers.
Yeah.
But that's the problem right there. And the thing that really frustrates me about this the most is that I was interested, even though it was poorly written from the start.
Yeah.
I was intrigued because, as we know, Stephen King is a genius when it comes to creating worlds.
Yes.
That are like ours, but there's something slightly amiss. And if you have any type of skills in adapting one, you know, if you have any type of skills at all in adapting a Stephen King novel, then you're going to bring some of that there because it's his world. It's his world. And that aspect, the world aspect, the mythos, even though it was superficial, it could have been so much more richer. Mm-hmm. But that part of the movie, the mythos, the mythology they use that governs this world, it does work and it does intrigue you. But they never commit.
Yeah.
They never commit to it.
They don't. And it's funny that you say that, because some of the strengths for us, the good things that we got out of this movie, comes directly from drawing that mythos, drawing those worlds into this narrative, into this movie. The narrative sucks. It's a okay adaptation for half of it, and then it falls apart, changing things just because.
Yeah.
To shock you, I guess, at best. But it's not, again, not scary.
No, it's not.
Which is the biggest...
It's laughable.
This is the biggest Achilles heel of any horror movie, is that if it's not scary, it's not good.
Yeah.
But the parts that do work is some of the production design. There's a very real sense of dread, and it feels pretty good for about half of the movie. And the world feels real for the real parts. And then there's this clear break where... it gets a little surreal. It gets a little mysticism. It gets a little of, we've crossed over to a different place.
Right. And I like that quite a bit.
And it's very true to the book as well. There's this clear barrier. Once we get across it, we're not exactly where we think we are. We're on Earth, but maybe we're not. It's hard to say.
I think it's seen a Stephen King movie.
You know what we're talking about.
What we're talking about. All of his movies, for the most part, if you know what to look for, are connected, just like his books. It's the Stephen King verse. Mm-hmm. All of his books, for the most part, all intertwine. Even if though they're separate stories, they all reside in the same universe. And they're usually connected by what? I don't want to do a spoiler yet, but they're usually connected by his greatest epic of all time. Mm-hmm. That's the one series that connects everything together. So you have that sense of surrealism that has to be a part of a Stephen King movie like this.
And there's a touch of that.
Yes. And every time we went there, every time they took us there, I was captivated.
That's when it got interesting.
Yeah.
There's some good production design. It feels like a well thought out. That was the part that they actually read of the book. The mysticism and supernatural elements in that moment.
I think ultimately what happened is that they just like you said, it was like as if the writer or director went to the Wikipedia page and just, I kind of got an idea of what this is about.
I don't have to read it. It's close enough.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a perfect way to say it, because it just never fully forms. Like you mentioned that a big part of Stephen King's book is about dealing with death.
With death.
There's a statement about life and death, and it's very philosophical. Where do you go when you die? Do you go to heaven? Do you go to hell? Is there a God? Is there a devil? These are the questions that are presented in the book. And these are also the questions that are kind of presented in the movie. Mm-hmm. And like we have been saying, the biggest problem is there's no commitment. They don't fully commit. And that's another thing that ultimately hurt this movie, because they could have used that philosophical aspect to keep the entire movie cohesive and tight.
A strong spine.
But instead, they use it as a throwaway line to set up the death of
a character.
And then they never really use that ever again.
It doesn't mean anything beyond what they're saying at that time.
Right.
And that's the thing, is that the book is so rich in that questions. The book is about, again, spoilers, I guess, in some way.
I think most people understand what the story is about.
We won't go into direct spoilers, though. How does the human mind, how do you emotionally deal with death? There's different viewpoints presented in the beginning of the story. There's different outcomes of it by the end of the story.
And let's get into that. Like, for example, the father is, I wouldn't say he's an atheist, but he's
agnostic at best.
Yes. He doesn't believe in an afterlife.
He's a man of science.
Yes. And that comes into play, and it works. That aspect works, and it kind of governed his character for the most part.
As I think it does in the story originally.
He was probably the most consistent. But then you also have aspects dealing with the wife and her tragedies that she went through as a child, and dealing with the death of family and learning to understand it as a child and not to blame yourself. And then they use that as a bit of a backdrop for the kids and her questions of life and death and having to deal with the death of a pet. Mm-hmm. And these are very real problems that many parents have to go through. I mean, I still remember this day when I had to explain death to my 3-year old, you know, and I said, well, this is what happens, and you have to find the right words. And it's a very uncomfortable conversation because kids don't understand it. No matter how hard you explain it to them or how well you think you explain it to them, it's very hard to for them to grasp it.
Well, and
because they haven't experienced it in any way. Yes. And that, again, is a great aspect of this film. But unfortunately, because of the shoddy writing, it never comes through.
Yeah.
They set it up and they kind of go back to it and they use it as a way to, I guess, set up the villainy of the movie. But there's a lot of assumptions. They're assuming the audience is going to follow. And if you and I have problems following, Thomas, which I give ourselves credit for being able to dissect and interpret films.
Yeah.
If you and I are scratching our head and said, okay, this isn't hard to understand. We get it. But fuck, like that's
all you have.
That's a jump, man. Like you're just assuming people are going to follow this movie.
And I think I only followed it as well as I did because I had just recently read the book. Because again, it feels like it's on fast forward and it rushes through for an hour and 41 minute screen time for no reason. The strongest moments of the book come from those relationships and those quiet conversations that Lewis Creed and Judd Crandall have. That talk about a man's morality and a man's decision and how we deal with death, the moral questions, life after what Judd has seen, what Lewis is considering doing, all these things. Those best moments are those quiet moments when they're together in the kitchen table setting. And in the book, in the movie, these themes, not even themes because they don't have themes in the movie, these ideas
What's
of
that?
Death. These ideas of how you're going to tackle it and how different people view it are used primarily as setup for a couple of jump scares for an element of the book that was dragged far too long and used more than 3 times for the same scare.
Yeah.
That's not good horror. That's not good writing. And that's not a good adaptation. It's just not.
It's really hard to
be positive
anything.
About this because from like a technical aspect, it's made pretty well, but the editing and the violence aspects fall very short. Some of the creative decisions, I would say.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with what we said about mood. The mood itself is decent. There is fantastic sound design. The cinematography, I feel, is decent. But when you're dealing...
nothing stands out.
No, it's nothing groundbreaking, which this would be a perfect movie to do that type of stuff, to get a little experimental because you're dealing with the surreal.
Yeah.
You're dealing with, again, this is not a spoiler. If you know anything about Pet Sematary, you're dealing with an unworldly vibe, you know, almost like a netherworld vibe, like, or the afterlife for maybe that's even a better way to explain it. Like if you're delving into the afterlife, what feelings do you get? What comes to mind? A lot of mist, a lot of darkness. There's a lot of the unknown. There's a lot of shadows. And all of that is good. The sound design that accompanies that is great. But the cinematography doesn't deliver. I mean, it's okay, but there are so many missed opportunities because you're dealing with the larger than life. You could have really gotten in there with your camera and done some fucked up shit that would have created more scares.
More surreal.
Or at least help with the mood and help immerse us. Because every time we were about to be immersed in this world, they made a poor decision that ripped all of us out.
Yeah. And that's the thing, too, is that I can think of primarily a scene at the very end where if you had done it just a little bit differently, it would have had a very similar vibe to Us. Where there's one scene, it's like the poster scene almost, but there's one scene in the trailers of Us and where the family's out on the curb and you see them just in silhouette. It's very unsettling. There's a similar scene later in the movie that could have had the same vibe. Very just, I'm uncomfortable with what I'm seeing for the practical. And to your point, let's go there. We're going to another world in some respects. We're going down this surreal avenue. Let's get surreal. And we don't do it. We take the standard, you'd walk this way, they go up the hill, A, B, C shot. We don't do anything unique and different.
There's nothing exceptional.
There's nothing about it that makes you stand out and say, yeah, that was a great shot. That was a great scene.
Right.
And that's the thing, is that when horror is being pushed, even by one director, beyond what we've expected for many, many years, this is going to get graded a little bit harsher. And what I can't understand is how this currently has a higher rating on Rotten Tomatoes of 72%. Now, admittedly, that's just shy of hitting into the yellow section on Metacritic, but, and it's not any criticism from audience members yet, but I just don't understand why people would think this does a decent job when I was never scared throughout this movie. I laughed a couple of times, and the story, even if you haven't read it, you can see what's happening from a mile away.
I don't understand how it's even at 72%. I'll be honest with you. This should be
40.
I mean,
50.
I mean,
I'm going by like 5 out of 10.
I would at least say, what's the bottom line before you become rotten, or before you could become
below 60, I believe.
Okay. This should be at least maybe a 60, 61. Okay. Definitely not a 72. That blows me away. Just to give our listeners kind of a baseline of where we're at. Most people know that listen to Critique Revolve know that I absolutely hated the Halloween remake.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was just terrible on so many levels. You're
very aggressive about it.
It's bad. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That movie was better than this.
Yeah. You know why? I think
at least they committed to something.
They committed to something.
At least they committed to it. They created a mood and they went with it. I didn't agree with it for what that movie was supposed to be. Halloween was supposed to be a slasher film,
mm-hmm.
and there wasn't even a lot of slashing. There wasn't even a lot of killing. It wasn't scary at all. But at least they committed to their tone and their world, and they didn't backtrack or change their mind. And that's why, to me, Pet Sematary is even worse than that, because they didn't even want to commit to anything.
Yeah.
I honestly don't understand how I don't understand how John Lithgow, you know, read this script. It's like,
yeah
guys, let's do this.
I
mean, fuck, dude, I wait on hands and knees for a new Lithgow project, whether it be a TV show or a film. And it's sad that this is his latest film.
Yeah.
It's kind of a blemish on his career. The guy is fantastic, and they didn't even use him enough.
He's got maybe 10, 15 minutes of screen time.
Yeah, and you know what?
He's the most prominent character outside of Lewis in the original book.
And I want to say this because, again, I didn't read the book, but you told me that he's a very important part
of
the book and that he is—
You have no story without him.
He's like the best friends with our lead, Lewis.
Yep.
Okay, and I looked at you. I'm like, wait, what? They're best friends, because that didn't even come off. He came off
as a
creepy old man, maybe even a pedophile. That's how he came off.
He's the kindly old man who's best friends with Lewis and friends of the family. He's that trusty neighbor who cares about the kids, who wants the best for them, who Rachel sees as a second father. None of that.
Comes through
in this movie.
Yeah, because like I said, I did not.
You didn't even know.
I didn't know. I thought the whole time, I thought he was going to be a bad guy.
Well, they paint him as a villain.
Yeah, I thought he was going to be a bad guy.
They flat out paint him as a villain.
And maybe that was the point. Maybe that's the direction they were trying to take. And maybe that's the only time they committed. But once they switched it on us and they let us know that he's not the bad guy, that he's not, you know, this villain, or he's not a pedophile, then
it still falls flat.
It still falls flat because we're wondering, okay,
well, what is he?
Then why did you waste so much time doing that? Because there was no payoff. At least make us think he's going to do something.
Yeah.
And there were parts at the very end of the movie that were questionable that might have clued us in that maybe he was bad. And we'll talk about that in spoilers, because I know you and I have different interpretations of that scene.
Mm-hmm.
But it felt like they didn't even quite know what they were going to do. And they probably looked at each other, the two writers or the two directors, Kevin and Dennis, like, hey, you know what? Let's not explain it. Like, let people interpret it on their own. And guess what? I'm okay with that. I'm okay with interpreting films, but you have to give us something to interpret.
Yeah. To me, this movie misses the mark so hard. It's a shame, because Pet Sematary is Stephen King's own words, it is the only book of his that really scared him. And as I read it, I was reading—
Is that
it,
what he said?
Let me find the exact quote here in just a second.
Go ahead. I'll look it up.
Yeah. It's shocking that it goes— Here it is. King has gone on record stating that of all his novels he has written, Pet Sematary is the one which genuinely scared him the most. because it is so dark and depressing. I was reading this on vacation. I had 2 weeks off of all important matters in life. I was reading it. I stopped because it was depressing me. And I said to myself, I don't need this on my vacation. I will read this later. And I switched books halfway through because it was getting to me that way. And for this to have such a deep understanding of how we react as humans towards death and what would drive us to do crazy things, for the movie to have zero elements of it, it feels like a sandwich that's just bread. There's nothing in the middle. And honestly, this will be forgettable. It's worse than Halloween, because Halloween, you'll remember that they did one with Jodie Foster again. Or not Jodie Foster.
Jamie Lee Curtis. Are you getting all your old white ladies messed up?
I am. They all blend after a while.
Oh,
Jamie Lee Curtis.
I don't even want to say they're old. That's
they'll remember that she was in it again, the sequel proper with her.
Right.
Pet Sematary will be forgettable. There's nothing about this it that stands out.
This is going to be the second Dark Tower.
Yeah, I'll forget that it came out.
Because nobody wants to remember Dark Tower.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, that movie? What? I don't remember that. Prank caller.
Yeah. I think with that, we can probably move into spoilers now. Truthfully, don't waste your time with this one. I'm sorry. If you have any interest in it, read the book. It's a much better experience. And even probably the old movie is definitely more faithful than this one is. So
we'll go to a quick break, and then when we get back, we'll get into spoilers.
Spoilers.
What are you looking at, nerd? Huh?
I thought I was looking at my mother's old douchebag, but that's in Ohio.
Geek Out Saturdays.
And then, like, ants eat your remains. Like, those books got real dark.
For kids.
Bandersnatch. Or, like, one of them, like, you get...
The fact that Marvel's been doing it for 10 years doesn't mean it's easy.
Hold on, though. Take Marvel out of the equation and forget that they don't even exist. Television has been doing this for decades.
And I stumbled upon it while I was hunting alligators. And this guy starts whistling at you. He beckons you. So I thought it was a mission, like a side mission. So I went, and then I realized what it was when it was too late. Yeah. I walked in, the guy starts...
And that's how they go out. Like, because the rebirth, when they ditched the New 52, because the New 52, they weren't always on the best of terms. They're back together, or, you know, they end up getting back together because they feel something they don't know. They just feel like the universe is pulling them together.
Catch up on your favorite Rayman Digital Geek shows every Saturday. DC on CW, Back to Tank, Weird West Radio, The Crossroads, and more. Geek Out Saturday on Rayman Channel 001.
Free stuff is awesome, but free stuff that will spice up your bedroom is even better. Just go to adamandeve.com and select almost any one item for 50% off, and then we'll load on the free stuff. Just enter this very exclusive code, RAINMAN, at checkout, and you'll get 10 tantalizing free gifts, including a sexy item for him, a special toy for her,
ooh,
and a third item you'll both enjoy.
Ooh.
And 6 extra special bonus items that are sure to rev your engine, pique your curiosity, and even blow you away. Plus,
free shipping!
Always sent in discreet packaging. Go to adamandeve.com now. Get 50% off plus the 10 free gifts when you enter the exclusive offer code RAINMAN. Again, that's RAINMAN. Because without it, no free stuff. That's RAINMAN at adamandeve.com.
We're back for some spoilers now in regards to Pet Sematary. And this might be a little quicker than normal simply because we've kind of talked a little bit about it already. The biggest thing is that they've changed so much of the story for no other reason than to surprise you. This is spoiler heavy. So in the book, Gage, the little boy, gets hit by the truck. And he's the one who dies. And the second half of the book is all about the family's crumbles entirely. Lewis is dead inside. Rachel can't stop crying. Their marriage suffers. The in-laws get involved and blame him for the death of their son. Judd Crandall, as his best friend, doesn't know how to help him. Wants to do anything, but he knows that he's shown him the Pet Sematary with Church, and he knows that he shouldn't go down there because sometimes dead is better. None of that despair, none of that seeing a man driven to his worst base desires out of a want to see your dead child for a brief moment comes through. I think the kid remains dead for all of 5 minutes in this actual movie. And I didn't feel for a minute that any of the actors really cared. We were all just waiting for the dead kid to show up.
Yeah.
And in the book, the dead kid aspect is the last couple of pages, last few chapters before it all just falls apart.
Yeah. Well, that.
And here it's like 20, 30 minutes for no reason.
Yeah. Well, that goes right back to the whole thing about commitment and not believing the actors, because now that we're in spoilers, I can say exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So this whole burial ground, right?
Yeah.
Okay. It's the whole lore is that the ground has gone sour. We don't know why, but that ground is diseased and it has opened the doorway or a gateway for evilness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And whenever you bury something in that burial ground, it will come back to life. And once you do that, you are permanently drawn to that place, allegedly beyond your own control. Like you are so, it's almost like an addiction.
The forest, the place, the Wendigo creature that runs the forest at that point, it has a mind of its own. It is a natural force that, like the ring from Lord of the Rings, wants to pull you into it.
If they didn't actually say it out loud during a horribly written exchange of dialogue, you would never know, because the actors never look that desperate. You're supposed to believe.
Like an alcoholic.
Because let's think of the setting, for example, for a second, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to believe that a man of science now believes that he's going to bury his daughter and she's going to come back to life, okay? That's quite a leap. That's quite a jump. And
that's
yes,
huge.
There has been scenes where he has been seeing spirits and things talking to him, and he saw gateways and he traveled, you know.
But he thinks they're dreams at this point.
He thinks they're dreams, right. But my point is that if your kid died, who in their right mind would dig up that child from a grave, carry her across town, and bury her in the ground so that she can come back to life? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're supposed to believe that he would do that, but they never allowed us to see him slowly slip into
madness.
Into madness. There was never that.
There was no despair.
There was no break from the death of his daughter. It went from his daughter died, and now I'm going to bury her in this ground. But we were led to believe through an exchange of dialogue that you are obsessed with it and that you're mm-hmm. drawn to it. And yet we never actually seen any of the actors do that. In fact, the reason why our lead, Lewis, even buries his daughter over there is because Judd, at one point in his life, also buried one of his animals. And we also believe something else, possibly.
Yeah.
That's never really clear.
Well,
and he is the one who suckers Lewis into burying a dead animal over there.
Right.
And he apologizes towards the end of the movie saying, I couldn't control myself. We're drawn. I am very sorry I did this to your family. I'm sorry I showed you this place. I shouldn't have done that. And I'm like, well, okay, if you're in such duress and you can't control your actions and there's a form of addiction,
why don't
we see it? We never even saw that struggle.
Not a moment.
No struggle between, oh my God, put the guy in cold sweats, have him, you know, get stir crazy.
Look around a little bit like, oh, I shouldn't do this.
Turn him into Jack Nicholson in The Shining.
Yeah.
Something to make us believe that he has gone mad enough that he's going to bury his child in a ground and wait for her to come back alive. We don't see it. And that's my biggest problem. I could forgive 90% of the movie. In fact, I said that to you after mm-hmm. we walked out of the theater because you were huffing and puffing.
I was pissed.
Within the opening 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, calm down, Thomas. Like, give it a shot. And I forgave the movie for the first act, forgave the movie for the second act. I'm like, all right, there's a lot of cool aspects that I'm intrigued by.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they just jumped to him and there was no form of disbelief. And that's the problem. When you're dealing with a grounded world, For the most part,
right.
You're dealing with characters that are grounded in reality. That's a better way of saying it.
Yeah.
And suddenly the supernatural has been introduced to them. And you're dealing with a guy who believes in nothing He does not believe in any of that stuff. There's got to be a moment of disbelief. And there was never that moment. It went from zero to 60.
Uh-huh.
And then the movie was over.
Yeah, in an hour and 40 minutes. And you're right. The biggest thing is that I'm supposed to feel something. And I think this is a failing of the directors based on a bad script, because the actors can't, the actors are strong, and yet they can't give us anything. Not for a second did I believe that either person, Rachel or Lewis, truly lost a child. Not for a second did I believe that Judd was really driven to tell, to expose the truth of the pet cemetery to Lewis. And I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here from the book, so bear with me just briefly. At one point in the book, the biggest where Judd tells him, you should not bury your kid. I know what you're thinking. Do not do this. He tells him a story about Timmy Baderman, somebody who died in World War II back when he was much younger, whose father buried him in the cemetery. And he came back, and then he started traumatizing people in town. He reeked of death. He looked like a ghoul. He looked like a zombie. He would tell people things that he had no, quote, earthly way of knowing, that secrets and lies or things about their family that no one knew, like your wife's been sleeping with everyone and she hates you at night and all these things that are fucked up. And Judd and a couple of people went to confront Timmy, take him out, essentially get Bill, his dad, to kill this monster that he brought back to life. And he says that whatever came back was not Timmy, but some sort of demon that possessed his corpse. He starts talking in a different voice. It's very demonic. It's like Satan's mouthpiece came through this body. And Judd and the others leave, to the point later that the dad kills his own reanimated son and then himself because he's so upset with what he brought back. In the movie, there's one article he Googles that says Timmy Baderman walking the streets alive again, and that's it.
Yeah.
And that should tell you how little they fucking cared about the actual themes, the emotion behind this story to make it a Wikipedia search.
Right. And I'll be fair. I don't usually review movies based on their book.
True.
Because they're two different mediums.
They are.
However, how hard would it have been
to have a storytelling moment
to give us just
One.
5 minutes when you're dealing with a script that's already filled with exposition,
already still short,
already filled with exposition, a lot of jibber jabber in order to explain things. Then why not add a story like that, that we could even
see maybe
in a form of a flashback? They already showed flashbacks already in this
show
movie.
Show us a flashback. Do an artistic flashback. Yeah. Do a silent flashback where we get the vibe and tell us through visual storytelling, not express dialogue, what happened, and let us feel those emotions. You're, like you said, you've already filled your script with that. It's the only reason I know what the fuck's happening. So why not just go for that extra moment so that we have true understanding of what we're dealing with? But in the movie, like you said, the characters never, a man of science never bats an eye that, well, I guess I'm traveling 5 miles out of my way to bury a cat in some weird haunted area and not ask any questions about it.
Yeah, and there, yeah.
From a man he barely knows, according to the movie.
Yeah, it just,
it misses the mark.
Yeah, it really does. And when it comes to the scare tactics, let's get into that briefly,
because
I do have some complaints about that. As I said during the first part of our review, I said that there was two scary moments that they used several times.
Yeah.
And one of them is the semi truck, which we saw in the trailer.
Right.
They did that various times. And I understand why they would do that, because
it's
setting
up.
It was foreshadowing to a death. Right.
Right.
So that's fine. But when that's your only real fear that makes you jump, that's a problem. And then the second fear tactic they used was a flashback sequence that had to do with the wife, and it had to do with her childhood and the reasons why she had issues with death and the problems she went through, because she felt like she was responsible for the death of her sister, and her sister was fucked up looking. She had
spinal meningitis.
Very serious issues, and she was horrid looking, like unsettling.
Twisted, broken.
I will be honest. There was moments where when they showed her, I had to look away from the screen because it was just disturbing. I did not like that. But my problem with that is they never used it in any way to motivate the character. Mm-hmm. Why bring something like that from her past and once again not commit? Why did this not come back in a meaningful way in order to explain something or push one of our characters forward? It never worked. You never really understood what was going on with her. Yes, you can assume that we were possibly seeing her again, and because she was being haunted. Right. They never explain things. And I understand there's the idea that this burial ground was obviously this area was possibly a place where
The barriers between life and death are thin.
Yes, that's exactly what I got from that. But that's because you and I are thinkers. Mm-hmm. They don't really explain that because there are random spirits that pop up and they're warning. And you're like, what are you from? Like, why are you warning us? What is your importance? We're sitting there waiting for the importance of this character that died a horrible, disturbing death at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And then it never really comes full circle. He's there as a bit of a harbinger, a warning saying, hey, do not do this, don't do that. But it never comes back to say who he is and why he's warning. They never ever commit to anything. It's just a bunch of ideas thrown out there.
And the thing is too, that entire bit with the sister and or the wife's sister and the horrible thing we see with her in the story, I keep coming to the book and I sound like one of those guys, but because the first rule of adaptation is if it doesn't work, cut it.
But the thing is,
if it doesn't work, let's add four more of it.
Right. But it's okay to bring these aspects up from the book because they're using those aspects from the book, but they're not actually using them correctly.
In the book, the story of the sister is told to explain why Rachel fears death and why she doesn't want Ellie to know, which is what leads to the cat burial and lies, which leads down Judd telling it all leads to something else.
It's a
domino effect. But in the movie, told and continues to come up for a couple of jump scares. And all of the way in which it happened in the movie is made up just for the movie.
Yeah.
It's all there just to scare us. Not once one way and twice another. And a third time they use a different thing. And she's haunted like it's something out of The Conjuring. It's the same scare done at least three times. And is only effective perhaps the first, maybe the second. And there's no purpose for it beyond, well, we needed to scare him. It's been 15 minutes and nothing's happened.
Yeah.
And that's a bad horror movie. When you're telegraphing the only thing that's going to happen.
Well, now also, the other thing that really just threw me out of the movie is there's moments that were intended to be scary.
Yeah.
And they were moments where not just you and I laughed, the entire theater laughed. Like it was a chuckle because it was cheesy.
You got to be kidding me.
And I'm like, okay, so you're trying. And number one, that's kind of, I mean, how do you make a cute cat scary to begin with? Right. And the way the movie ended was probably the most laughable part of the entire thing. There was a part, there's a scene where the dad, in order for him to stop all the mayhem, people getting killed, right?
Mm-hmm.
He locks his child up, a 2-year-old, in the car and talks to him like he's an adult and says, you stay in here, son. I need you to keep the doors locked and do not open them for anybody. And the son doesn't even talk.
Doesn't speak.
He doesn't speak.
He says, mommy, daddy.
And you're telling your son to keep the doors locked. He has no idea.
Now make sure to keep it in park. I don't want you rolling into the driveway. And if you hit that button there, you'll turn on the hazard lights so people can know if they drive by.
That part was laughable. You and I and our row started chuckling.
Yeah.
Like, that's weird.
Why the fuck are you talking to your kid like that?
And then when the movie ended, you have the cat that started this all jump on the hood of the car looking at the kid while the family, who are now essentially zombies, come walking towards the car. And it's supposed to be scary. It's fucking funny.
Well, the thing is, that was the scene I was talking about with you could have done a very similar shot to Us where these shadowy figures are just in the fog that slowly dissipates and you don't see any features, but you see them. And that would have been a oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Moment. But instead, they walk through completely normal, not staggered, not zombie-esque. They walk through looking relatively fine. Except maybe like, wow, camping sucks.
They had dirt on them. That's it.
camping really fucking sucked. That's what they came back with. And the cat walks up on the car like, I'm the leader.
Yeah, that's exactly what it
join
was.
Join my Thundercat army of undead. And you're like, what the shit is this?
That's exactly what I thought. That's exactly how I felt about it. I was like, it's like, is this like a cartoon? Like, hey guys, I'm going to take over the world now. It's yeah. It's my, the humans had their time. Now it's mine.
Time for the pussy to reign supreme.
It's the feline time. It was so fucking awful. And so the movie ended with a laugh that was not supposed to be funny. That's the worst. The directors and the writers must be embarrassed when they screen this.
And because people chuckle.
Like, fuck, we weren't intending for this to be funny.
It's
guys.
Like that It's Always Sunny where Max, like, I'm going for gasps. And then people start laughing at him at that play.
Yeah.
It's just sad what happened with this.
It's a poor movie.
It is.
And again, Halloween didn't have these types of problems. Halloween had a lot of issues with, as I've said, I'm not going to get into all of them again. They had their issues, but not like this.
This is just lazy.
It really was. But that's the problem with these Stephen King horror films, is that they rely on, what do I always say, big dick syndrome. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is Stephen King. He's It'll a big great. Swinging dick. People are going to come check it out no matter what, especially after the success of It. Everyone's hoping to get the next It. Mm-hmm. And guess what? This is not it. It's not it.
No, it's not. So
we can wrap if you're ready.
Yeah. With that, guys, don't see Pet Sematary. Save your time. Save your money. Watch the old one or read the book.
If you find
or it, do like the writer and director and read the Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah.
With
if you see it in the like the bargain bin at Walmart,
maybe
piss on it. No, I wasn't going to say to buy. Just piss on it.
Just whip out your junk and pee. Yeah.
If you see it in the bar, you will find it at the bottom of the bargain
bin.
Oh,
yeah.
It's not one of those movies that will be great. The only thing that can save this movie is if it becomes a cult classic because it's so bad.
Yeah. And it might.
Yeah. Which I'm okay with that, I guess.
And then we'll see you guys in 20 years for the screening. So, with that, that's going to do it here for Critique Revolve. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you all at the movies next time.
The Corova Milk Bar sold Milk Plus. Milk Plus Velocet, or Synthomesk, or Drencrum, which is what we were drinking. This would sharpen you up and make you ready for a bit of the old ultra-violence.